having seen how important kosher can be in the commercial sense, we also have to look at how in the commercial arena extra effort is needed to make kosher happen, and recognize that when companies choose to go kosher, they are undertaking additional controls, additional stringencies. And one of the areas I just want to kind of go through quickly is transportation requirements. A tank on the back of a truck, a tank in a tanker yard somewhere on the coast, has to be tracked. One has to know what was in it. One has to make sure that either the products it carries are all kosher and of the same type, that is, you cannot go back and forth between kosher dairy and kosher parv. And so you need to track these trucks, and you actually have special facilities in case a truck is the wrong situation, that they can be religiously cleaned, something we call equipment kosherization. We also find that when it comes to oils, which in particular are concerned because they are moved hot, and hot is a category that is more stringently controlled, that in fact we basically have two separate distribution systems in the United States for oils and shortenings. The oils that are kosher and shortenings go through one system, and things like tallow and lard and things of that sort, which are very definitely not kosher, go through a separate system. The key then to this multiple systems is the fact that in the real world, products can be made kosher because equipment can be made kosher. And the same, by the way, holds for halal. There is an equivalent process for cleaning up equipment for halal. So that the process of equipment kosherization means we can take, for example, non-kosher equipment made of the right materials, and not all materials count, but we can take some of these and we can clean them up with an official procedure and make them parv. And then if we've got parv lines, we can immediately go to dairy lines and dairy manufacture. But once it's something is dairy, to go back to parv, the rabbinical people need to come back in and do the clean over. Now, the normal equipment that we have in food operations, both food service as over here and food production, are stainless steel and other materials like that, which can be kosherized. Again, in the industrial world, we do more of this going back and forth. In food service, because you have so many little pieces of equipment, it is much easier to simply run two separate kitchens. Because the equipment kosherization process is so critical, particularly in the food industry, the manufacturing industry, I want to at least give you a very simplistic, broad overview of the three levels of equipment kosherization and roughly what that means. If you're working with cold products, defined as less than 120 degrees Fahrenheit, then you simply have to wash. So if, for example, you were bottling cold dairy product and wanted to switch to a cold parv product, before you could make the switch, you would have to wash the entire production line, all the tanks and pipes, but you could do it by a simple cleanup. However, once you're over 120 degrees Fahrenheit, you are considered hot. You are considered cooking. And so for normal food products, you would do your regular cleaning at the end of the shift, at the end of the day. And then the part that makes it tricky is you need to keep the equipment idle for 24 hours. Following that, you need to flood it with boiling water. And that means heating large quantities of boiling water. This process is normally done on Monday mornings before the first shift comes in at 7 o'clock. So the rabbis and their staffs are in the food plants at about 4 a.m. on Monday mornings because the plants need to have this process of equipment kosherization completed to get the day started. Finally, if it is a dry baking type of situation, there is the need to actually heat the equipment to glowing red temperatures. Basically, they use a blowtorch, and it is this a need in a baking situation that is so difficult that is part of the reason why both Nabisco and Keebler, the transition to kosher takes so long. They had to wait until they could have an opportunity where it was economically possible to get into each of their ovens to clean them and then to actually blowtorch them before reassembling them. So they have to be disassembled and reassembled. So it's a very complex process to do something that involves a baked good. So, but basically, depending on what you have, you are able to make this transition from one status to another, and the food industry depends on this in many cases in offering the large quantity of kosher foods that are currently available, and the same kinds of processes with slightly different rules are used by the Muslim community in order to prepare equipment for halal productions. Although we've mainly concentrated on kosher because one, it is a more elaborate set of rules, and two, it's more highly developed in the United States, I do want to say a few words about the halal market as a market. In the United States, it is really just getting started. There are some number of halal stores, smaller stores around the country in neighborhoods where there is a Muslim community. There are some manufactured goods. We looked at one earlier, the one with the dual labeling. There are a number of products that now have the Afanka label. There are other supervisions coming on board which are doing manufactured products. Again, one has to recognize that this whole system is much more developed in other countries, certainly in the countries that are currently Muslim or have large Muslim populations. This whole approach to marking products and making products that are halal is well developed. And that really covers all of North Africa, the Middle East, going into Southeast Asia, and includes even a country like India, where only 20% of the population is Muslim, but in fact is, I believe, the second or third largest Muslim country, just because it's such a large country. So they have an infrastructure in these countries such that many of their manufactured goods are made to halal standards. In the next slide, I'd like to show you the symbol of the Afanka group a little more blown up so it's easier to see. The crescent M that we talked about earlier with the military meals. This is the largest certification agency in the United States. It is a very mainstream, if anything slightly stricter than mainstream standard for the Muslim community. It is the official agent for Malaysia, which turns out to be the country with probably the strictest halal Muslim certification laws as a state, even though Malaysia itself is multicultural. It is not a predominantly Muslim country. Interestingly enough, many of the Middle Eastern countries are actually at times more liberal than the Malaysian and in recent years, Indonesia. Whether one is using a hekshar to tell a kosher product or a halal marking to tell a halal product, it is important as consumers, if you are serious about keeping kosher or keeping halal, to understand who is in fact putting the symbol on. Just because it has a kosher or halal symbol doesn't really guarantee that it meets a person's individual standards. So one needs to be able to question the supervising agency, and it is perfectly appropriate as consumers to call them and ask questions and to learn about the product, and to also double check that in fact in the case of kosher, its parv dairy meat status is correct. As a help, there is a magazine called Kashrus Magazine that once a year does an up-to-date listing of all known kosher symbols in the world. It is not just the United States, but anything where that product at least has come into the United States from anywhere in the world. It gives you the name of the agency and the contact information, but it's important to recognize that it does not make a judgment as to whether it is normative, right of normative, or more liberal than normative. So you do have the responsibility as a consumer of kosher goods of making sure that what you're using them for is consistent with your standards and that you've done your homework. One question we're often asked about kosher is, are these health laws? Kosher are not health laws. They are commandments that were given to the Jewish people to obey. And the example that many people cite, well, it's a health law, is because we all know about trichinosis and pork. And therefore, clearly the real reason that we got them was we gave them a religious overtone, but really what we're worried about was trichinosis. That argument is fallacious. There are two problems with that argument. First of all, we have identified and found samples of mummified pork in the pyramids. And I would remind people that it was the Jews in Egypt who helped build those pyramids. So that was the time when these laws were coming into being. And the mummified pork has no cysts. There are no signs of the organism, the parasite, that causes trichinosis. And the scientists tell us that, in fact, you should see those cysts in mummified pork. The other part of the problem is that people in those days did not understand cause and effect for many of the diseases, even when they were only 24-hour incubation periods. Trichinosis has a very long incubation period. There is no way that somebody could eat a product and figure out that because they ate pork 10 days ago, that they got sick 10 days later. To think that they made that intellectual leap is quite difficult to assume. And recognize, as we now know, all of our flesh food products need to be carefully handled and properly handled in order to be safe to eat. One can get sick eating beef, as unfortunately we've learned today. On the other hand, the halal Muslim laws are predicated on and speak in terms of health laws. They are concerned about health. We talked about intoxication, we talked about drug use, and they do view the whole body of halal laws as health laws. And so that's a place where there really is a distinction between the intellectual religious framework for kosher and for halal. Another question that causes confusion is this issue of clean versus unclean. In looking at the Bible, we have this term clean used for what is acceptable and unclean that are animals that are not acceptable, or at least some animals that are not acceptable. And that is a religious term and has to do with defilement. It is not a hygienic term. So that if a pig, which is unclean, a dead pig, touches a dead cow, the cow is defiled and makes the cow not kosher. So even though you have a kosher animal, if it comes in contact with a pig, which is unclean, it no longer is acceptable. However, interestingly enough, shellfish, which are also prohibited, are detestable. That is a weaker category, and it is very important for my fishing folk, because what this means is that if you bring in a net full of dead fish and dead shellfish, the fact that the dead fish and the dead shellfish touch each other, one does not defile the other. So fish touching shrimp are okay. Pork touching beef makes the beef unclean. So those are some concepts that we've tried to summarize, clean and unclean, the rule of role of health, and that then will lead us to the final points that I want to make, which is to at least step back and look at the broad philosophical context for kosher and look at an important philosophical statement.